Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and welcome to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I recently had the pleasure, and I mean that really sincerely, of talking with David Edwards from his work in Paris about his recent book, The Lab, Creativity and Culture, and that came out with Harvard University Press in 2010. Now, to say that I found the reading of this book and the ensuing conversation inspiring is a dramatic understatement. This is a wonderful book. It aims to be both a manifesto, but in the best sense of the word, a kind of call for difference and a statement about what it can mean to think beyond the boundaries of the way we usually think about the arts, about the sciences, and about what can happen when we create spaces, be they physical laboratories with laboratories conceived broadly, or be they sort of emotional and mental spaces to bring otherwise what we think of as otherwise disparate fields of inquiry and types of inquiry into dialogue. It's a wonderful book. It's inspiring, again, in all kinds of ways. And we had a really good time talking about both the material here and the possibilities of using the lab and using art science as a concept to inspire and provoke all kinds of innovations in the classroom, on the street, in the museum, and far beyond. So I hope you enjoy. So hello, David.
Hello, Carla.
We're here today at New Books in Science, Technology, and Society to talk with David Edwards about his book, The Lab, Creativity and Culture. Now, this is a book that I had just a tremendously pleasurable time reading. It's a book that works on so many levels for so many different kinds of communities. And clearly, I think that's the point, and we'll get to that. But also, the reason why I was interested in talking with David today for New Books in Science, Technology, and Society is that this is, I think, of particular relevance to the field of STS and people who work on and think with and think about STS in all kinds of institutional or non-institutional settings. So, David, thank you so much for making time to speak with us today.
Yeah, thank you again. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, my pleasure. So, David, can you start us off by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to this this subject, this topic?
Yes, this crazy intersection. Well, briefly, I am trained in actually chemical engineering and applied math, and early in my career focused on very theoretical kinds of things. Having said that, I got there in a sort of a very circuitous way and was sort of kicking and screaming through school, never very happy about it, and thought of doing many things, including pursuing a writing career at some point. But at the end of the day, math worked for me, and so I did that and ended up publishing an article in the journal Science in 1997, which caught the attention of some venture capitalists, which was a very unknown group of people to me at the time, and sort of frightening with the idea that they wanted to start a company based upon this article that I had done. And I was nevertheless flattered that they thought it was worth investing in, and ended up spending a year doing that. And the company sold. And I mention all of that only to say that it was quite a learning process for me. And when I came back to teach at Harvard University a couple years later, having run the subsidiary for a little while, I had this will, both to understand what had happened to me and also to give students an opportunity to learn what I felt I had learned by leaving the academy. And it was very much related to having somebody bet on a dream. Mm-hmm. And actually assuming the risk of that dream with friends of mine who are equally innocent and equally dreamers. And that led me to where I am right now, to just skip a few beats.
Okay, great. Now, you mentioned that you were interested in one point in a writing career. And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about that aspect of this project a little bit. I mean, as we'll see in the course of the next hour, or maybe a little bit less than an hour, there are a lot of aspects of this book and this project that are very intimately concerned with form, with the form of a project, an object, a group of people as a way to manifest a dream or a set of ideas. Now, how I'd love to hear a little bit about how you decided on this particular form. So as somebody who has been committed to writing, why write this book? Why write a book about this? And can you talk a little bit about how you decided on how you wanted this book to look, how you wanted to structure it?
Well, there's many ways to respond to that. And I appreciate you diving into the core of the story here. Let me maybe take a step back and say that since I was a little kid, I have always written and generally fiction. And my first experience with writing a work of fiction, I was in fifth grade and wrote a book, you know, wrote my first novel and gave it to my teacher, Mrs. Volkswagen, who I waited for her to come back and give me some feedback. And it was quite a personal story, actually not a very positive one. But I, for years and years, had this passion. And writing for me, ultimately, as I moved on in my career, became a way, still is a way, of understanding my life and the world around me, and quite a private obsession. So I have written many books that I never even made an effort to publish. When it came to the laboratoire and the lab, as I describe it in the book, which I did, just to jump back a second, I did after having gone to Harvard, I spent several years there, then I did leave and come to Paris, where I am right now, to open up this lab. And I did make a conclusion in that process that the kind of environment, kind of creative environment I had actually grown up in, having not really ever quite understood it or been able to articulate it, was a creative environment where the vocabulary of creation was artistic. And I had simply not had a forum in which I could adequately express that, although I searched out a forum of fiction. But in my public life, I was in a scientific environment. The forum of idea exchange was the peer-reviewed publication process and sort of scientific conference process, and which worked for me, but it was clearly not the primary forum of my sort of creative expression. And so I ultimately, in starting the laboratoire, began to write publicly, and I began to publish different books in the lab. The book that we're talking about here today was the last of a series of books that I wrote, all of which were quite like the other things I've written over the last 30 years in my own life, works in progress and efforts to understand the world around me. Now, that is sort of anecdotally interesting, maybe, but to, I think, answer more centrally your question, I don't believe today, given where I'm at, that creativity, innovation, or even the general notion of idea translation can be understood if we're not actually translating ideas. I think that the sort of detached view of how the river moves around our feet is not nearly as true or as meaningful, and I guess as a creator is understandable, as the view from the person who's sort of twisting around through the river and trying to explain what's going on. And so this book very much has a lot of that. It's It's the as we say in fluid mechanics, the Lagrangian point of view of how you innovate. And so I think there's a couple things that explain the form of the book. One of those is my own intuition that ideas are ultimately stories and are sort of fascinating to us and true in a certain way if they engage us as a good story does. And so the book is full of stories. And the second thing, it is very much a work in progress and an effort to understand creativity in this post-Google generation with the reader.
That's great. And I think you just mentioned fluid mechanics sort of offhand. It's really interesting because a lot of the people who I've spoken to in very different fields, but, you know, largely related to STS, who are writing about very different kinds of topics right now, are coming to fluid mechanics in the kind of Michel Serre sense as a model for understanding the creative process and understanding what it might look like to write history. And this sort of swirling back on itself almost musically, but still coming back to these central ideas of this almost manifesto, I think, as you put it in the book, as we'll get to, is very powerful, I think, as a means of translating these ideas.
No, I totally agree. Yeah, absolutely. I was trained that way, and so that I kind of think that way. But it is true that you find a lot of that language, and there is something that goes on in the both individual as well as collective creative process that is a kind of flow, a kind of mystical sort of process that we go through, and we sort of enjoy it more twisting through the water than we do standing on the river and kind of explaining how eddies form, basically. And so that's pretty fun.
That's right. And one, you mentioned also, incidentally, in the book, and I just ordered these two books, that you've also written two other experimental kinds of books, or at least two at the times of this publication, in the graphic novel format. This is Niche and Whiff, for listeners who haven't had a chance to read the book. What brought you to that particular form, and what's been the response or the engagement around those books, which seem really fascinating, other experimental writing genres that engage with this project?
Yeah, well, let me just say that I was several months before I opened the Laboratoire, which for your listeners is a cultural center in the center of Paris where we do experiments with leading artists and designers at Frontiers of Science. And before I opened the Laboratoire, there were lots of questions from the media and other people about what this would be and why actually I was doing it. And while I was in the midst of the first two experiments with Fabrice Hibert, who's a plastic artist here and a designer in Machibano, it was fun. I was really reassured, but I was pretty clueless how this would ultimately be understood by the public when we opened, because it seemed to me that the fun of it was actually the doing the experiment and developing these projects with these two, the artist and the designer. And so it occurred to me that a catalog in a conventional sense wouldn't make any sense, and that in a way the story here was an emotional one, was a ultimately a fictional one. And so I wrote Niche as a graphic novel, thinking of it as a novel catalog, as I called it. And I intertwined the stories of Fabrice and Mathieu. Fabrice, at the very last moment, didn't want his name actually associated with the character, so he's got another name. But ultimately, it's all true and none of it's true. And it caught what I understood to be the spirit of the opening exhibits. And I wrote the first with Jay Cantor, who's a well-known novelist, and the second I wrote by myself, but in both cases I had an artist, or in the second case a manga artist from Japan involved. And so they were just lots of fun, again, trying to understand, trying to communicate. And you know, I think that the books are sort of hard to penetrate for somebody who's not been there, but have a read and let me know.
Okay. When Amazon gets it to me, absolutely. So let's actually, you've mentioned the Laboratoire, so let's just dive right in for listeners. You start out, the book really sets out a series of themes that are going to be sort of weaving through the entire book, but are sort of treated in a concentrated way in a series of chapters on dreams, art science lab, education, culture, and so on and so forth. So you start us off by talking about the idea of a laboratory in general, broadly defined as a space of experimentation. And you introduce to us the laboratory that you are founding, or the set of laboratory art science labs that you are working with now, as being inspired by some similar initiatives by, or some related initiatives by Ken Arnold at the Wellcome Collection and Michael John Gorman at the Science Gallery in Dublin. Can you say a little bit about the founding of Le Laboratoire and the sources of inspiration that you found?
Absolutely. So, and I should just point out, there was a book called Art, Science, Creativity in the Post-Google Generation that I published before this book, which kind of goes back to the inspiration of the lab in a very kind of abstract way. To jump into chapter one and what I am driving at here, there is both in my own personal life, but actually very much internationally right now, this recognition that what we think of as culture is increased today, and what's resonating with significant portion of the culture consumers today is not the, say, 19th century form of culture, which was relatively static, relatively one-way communication. We were learning in the sense that my students might have learned 30 years ago in my class, but are not at all interested in learning today. It's much more of a dialogue, much more experimental. We are, as cultural consumers and cultural producers, increasingly the same individual, if you will, and also not really believing or even searching for an answer or a truth, but are much more interested in this sort of experimental process. And that is clear in music and contemporary art and dance and theater and probably in scientific research as well. So it's sort of a fascinating phase we've come into, where the process of creating, whether it's Apple computer and my iPhone 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's sort of this process. What is the iPhone actually? Or Yahoo, and I have pictures of the Yahoo page, which looked nothing like they looked a year ago or a year before. What is Yahoo exactly? And so there's this sort of process that is becoming increasingly the vector of culture delivery and exchange. And so that actually is very much resonant with the notion of a lab. A lab, if you walk into a lab, it's either not at all interesting. It's certainly not interesting because of the beakers and the whatever else is sitting on the lab benches or whatever machines. But it's interesting to the extent that you can perceive the ideas that are flowing through that lab. And so there are people who don't sleep and who are just totally obsessed when they come into the lab. Any of us who come in and are looking what's on the wall, we're complete. So there's something about the lab as a general concept that is very resonant with the sort of milieu of cultural exchange that we seem to be looking for today. And so the lab here in Paris and in lab environments that we've been opening in different parts of the world aims at curating that. And interestingly, what I point out in the book, there were a couple other experiments that are now just going super well. One in Dublin by Michael John Gorman, Science Gallery, and the other in London, funded by the Wellcome Trust, called the Wellcome Collection, and headed by Ken Arnold. And two just wonderful people, very different backgrounds. All three of us have very different backgrounds. And for three completely unrelated personal and institutional stories, opened within a year, institutions that had various and have various resonances with what we're doing here. The Science Gallery, as I said, in Dublin, a project with the Trinity College and the Wellcome Collection, which is much more of a museum kind of space with the Wellcome Trust. So I had kind of through the book, I sort of jumped back and forth between our different models. I think this is kind of like the early days of car production where we're figuring this out, and it's sort of fun to see which car is going to, maybe several, hopefully many as cars will be coming out of this.
That sounds great. And thinking about these different spaces that are kind of engaged in the same celebration of this process and of this dialogue and kind of creative juxtaposition as an ongoing passionate activity. It's not just one of the things that the book, I think, shows really well and inspires us to think about in really wonderful ways is that this doesn't just have to happen in these institutional spaces that are explicitly named thus, right? I mean, you sort of, and one of the spaces that this can happen, that this sort of spirit of experiment and spirit of embracing risk-taking and not being moved by fear is the classroom. So you do, I think, a really wonderful and inspiring kind of work here in giving credit to and showing the really generative force of students in making this happen and the way that you really transformed your classroom into an idea translation class at Harvard, which was really at the beginning of this process. Can you talk a little bit about this idea translation class yeah. and also maybe describe a typical class meeting for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, in the book point out that what we're talking about here, while it has all kinds of contemporary resonance, in the end is something familiar in family units and work environments and going back to the beginning of civilization. It is especially worth talking about, and I'm getting to the educational class here, but I just want to mention that the reason why these ideas seem hopefully disruptive and also worth talking about is that we've become so institutionalized for lots of good reasons over the last 50 years that whether it's culture or education, not to mention in many ways industry, we have become sort of functional within a certain department or within a certain kind of institution. And if our ideas lead us out of that, we sort of become dysfunctional. And that is so anti-human in a way, and it's so anti-historical in a way that it's worth talking about and actually giving a name to it. And so I talk about art science as this process that is just the core of creativity, but is sort of shoved out of our institutions and including out of our classroom. And so there's a lot going on right now, again, about in the context of education, nationally in the United States, internationally, certainly in Canada and elsewhere in the world, where we are recognizing, no, it's pretty weird. If you look at what CEOs are looking for in their incoming employees, these are qualities of open-mindedness, of listening well, of being able to take new information and process it towards problems that have never been defined before. And these kinds of abilities are really not being taught in the classical educational process. And so there's this rethinking of how should we be teaching. And so I think what's going on in my class is reflective of that. So what goes on in my class? So the notion here in this class is that we seed, so the class right now is called How to Create Things and Have Them Matter. And it invites undergraduates from any concentration. There are a few graduate students and design students. And we present at the beginning of the class 10 or more blue sky ideas. These are typically art and design ideas at some frontier of science. And now we tend to have a theme, some science theme, just to get some coherence. And we'll now come back to why. But anyway, so we give these ideas, really blue sky ideas that can be defined in a paragraph. And it may be, for example, you know, the world is, and I should mention, these are all ideas that are aiming at a major opportunity or need. And so it might be an idea like water transport, which becomes a major, you know, global problem, and particularly in certain parts of the world. And the biological cell is sort of a human way of transporting water. And so can you imagine new ways of carrying water based upon the biological cell? And so that idea, students kind of choose ideas that interest them, and we form groups them around these ideas. And for a part of the semester, the students are remaking that idea into an idea that they feel passionate about. And then finally, we work with them through the semester to help them convince us that A, there's a major problem, B, that hasn't been solved before, C, that they've got a really great idea, it could be a purely artistic idea, and give us background, and then try and sell us on a first experiment that we'll invest in and send them somewhere in the world to carry that idea a little bit further. And that's the class.
Mm-hmm. How do you maintain, you make a point later on in the book that it's very, very important for an art science lab to never be a purely commercial business, right? So in the context of, for those of us who are teachers on various levels, in the context of a class, there tends to be such an emphasis at the end of the day for the students on something that might be translatable in the educational context as a purely commercial level, right? The grade, the outcome.
Yep.
How do you preserve structurally that sense of creativity that you're aiming for in the context or in a context which is so institutionally defined as being about the outcome for a lot of the students?
So, well, it is, as you can imagine, an elusive goal here. And what's critically important is that the students and, or at least some of the students in each group, have this passion moment. And what I should mention, what is turned out to be critical in my view, is that we have resources that have, they don't have to be great resources, but resources that come from different interested parties. It could be foundations, or it could be groups inside the university that are set aside, and there's this dialogue going on with students from about a third of the way into the semester, saying, you know, this is about a class, but it's also about your idea. And if you really want to pursue this idea, we actually have resources that we could bet on this idea with. And so that's one thing, and I'll come back to the second thing, is that these ideas, we then encourage these ideas to move forward in different translational environments. And I'm going to be a little bit abstract here because the question is a sort of a profound in many ways, and then I can get to be more concrete. It's important in general, in this idea development process, to help the students see how to share their ideas as cultural forms. In other words, to find audiences and ways of installation, exhibition that can engage public interest, could be a small public or a large public, around the idea itself and the kind of the idea motion in a sense that I was mentioning earlier. It's kind of most interesting in a way is not iPhone 1, 2, 3. It's kind of iPhone 1, 2, 3. It's kind of this translation process. And so if you look at Silicon Valley or off Broadway or a couple of environments I talk about, if you look at really interesting innovation environments and what I think is most important about those environments, there's always a cultural community that can look at what everybody else would call failure if they're measuring the outcome. And that environment can say, this is success. And in a Silicon Valley environment, it's all these startups that are losing money. And if anybody were to measure, like, well, how profitable are these companies? Well, they're not. They're losing money. But anybody who has that culture can go in that, you know, a startup X and sort of know in a certain cultural way that, you know, this is really a worthwhile activity. And it's kind of the off-Broadway environment where people are maybe not singing perfectly on key and there maybe things are happening that shouldn't happen in a Broadway production, but there's an audience there that loves that and is specifically interested in the kind of imperfection. And so you're looking to, A, to answer your question. Make the passion of the students so that this is increasing, that the grade is kind of, let's get beyond that, right? And so that's, and secondly, and to do that, you do need to kind of put a certain bet on the table and give the students the credibility that they often don't feel in moving into this kind of really dreamy environment. And the second thing is to help them move into a translation environment where they can exhibit their ideas and get these ideas moving before they have to write a business plan, if they ever do. And I should also say that we never have all of these ideas. We completely focused on commercial sort of issues. And so I would say at least half are humanitarian or artistic, just purely artistic. And that's just a fabulous environment for everyone, because there's at the end of the day, just a fundamental human interest in all of these kinds of outcome and processes. And so I think that's not quite an answer.
Oh, yes, it is. No, it's great.
Okay, good.
No, it's great. I mean, and it sort of, it makes me, you know, what you're describing and what you're talking about and this energy and passion also evokes implicitly another theme that really runs through the entire book and animates a lot of the energy coming out of this book, which is the importance of a youth or a kind of youthfulness, right? And that doesn't have to mean young people chronologically, but sort of a spirit of the kind of youthful risk-taking and youthful band-making, as you talk about creative bands, that inspire exactly the kind of sort of creative risk-taking in all fields that you're aiming for. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, thank you for bringing that up. That's one of the great unspoken truths of creating and innovating, is that, you know, we all become children in the process. And one of the things that I say to my students, my first class, inevitably, that my goal in this class is to preserve the one thing that you are doing everything to eliminate, and that's your innocence, right? And so there's something that goes on in the educational process where we're sort of beating out of our students the notion of raising a hand if they don't know what they're going to say, or actually making any kind of a suggestion or prediction if they can't know the outcome. And if you think about it, that's so ludicrous in a world where, you know, nobody, not the President of the United States, not anybody really knows almost anything actually about what tomorrow's going to be. And so to think that we're raising kids only to talk about what they know is sort of frightening. So there's something about and I talk in the book quite a bit about my own children. I have three little boys, 9, going on 11 and going on 13. And I have, you know, clearly am inspired watching them and their comfort with their innocence and how they use it to their advantage. And so I try and analyze that a bit in the book. And as you mentioned, the band making kind of thing, how they, you know, when we start anything, and I think about theater a lot, there's a lot that goes on in starting, you know, companies or even writing a novel where there's something theatrical happening. And the shared risk taking that happens just before the curtain goes up. And it's always fascinating to any of us who watch how performances come about with all this chaos. And there's nobody really in charge, but somehow it all happens and it goes up and there it is. And it's fun, partly, even though we may not admit it, because we're all kind of taking a big risk and we're sharing it. And we're not kind of really admitting to each other that this could be a complete disaster that we'll never get over. And kids kind of, because they are every day, every year of their young lives, walking onto a new stage, doing that. And so I talk about my three boys who are very different, and yet they all sort of minimize their risk in a certain way by finding friends whose interpretation of risk is kind of like they kind of ignore the risk that they're really, which is sort of fascinating to me.
One of the really useful things about that, I think, in the book and the way you've written this, is that by bringing your family explicitly into the discussion and into the way you're writing about this process, you're also strategically helping to break down one of the things that holds, at least for academics reading this, the kind of sense of an institutional coherence and the demands of an institution, in your life as a unit in an institution, together, which is this idea that, you know, your personal life and yourself and your home and your family are separate from this, you know, sort of work realm. I think increasingly, a lot of us are really starting to push against that, and push past and ask, you know, why should that be the case? That makes no sense if we're trying to actually integrate passion and personal commitment, and a more public, you know, more of a public engagement into what we're doing in these four walls of a building, on a college campus, for example. So I think that actually strategically in the way you wrote this, really worked well for the overall theme.
That's really nice to say that. I mean, I think it's, you know, and there's probably lots of reactions to that. And as you are super aware yourself, what is possible and what is not, list is quite long in an academic setting. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And I understand that. But I think that for all the reasons we're kind of talking about, many of those are becoming less relevant today. And I think it's, you know, young faculty like you who need to be kind of leading the change, and you are. I think that it's quite fun to watch.
Well, we're all trying, but I think it's changing. And I think another thing that's really changing, and to bring up another theme that really threads through a lot of these chapters, but that you talk about in particular when you're talking about this culture chapter, is that part of this is also, or part of the way that an institutional sort of very hermetic way of defining work and idea construction is built is on this idea that error should be invisible, that along the way of actually creating a product, things happen, but, you know, when things go wrong, you don't actually see them. And you talk about the importance of art as a process and the importance of process as being itself integral to this, you know, this set of values that you're trying to, I think, very effectively celebrate here. And you do this by taking us through a series of exhibits that actually were put on at your art science labs, one by Ryoji Ikeda and one by Shilpa Gupta. And this process of actually seeing all the steps along the way that weren't, you know, sort of clean and perfectly sealed off and that didn't always manifest as the projects or product we can point to and push and spray something at was really, really helpful here. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Just to jump onto the story of Shilpa for a minute, it was, and then to maybe step back and talk more broadly as you are here. Mm-hmm. So Shilpa is Shilpa Gupta is a contemporary artist. She lives in Mumbai, and she she's young, she must be in her early 30s, and is fascinating artist and quite engaged in political and social issues. And she was interested, came here to Paris, and we talked many times, and we were interested. I was interested in helping her come to some frontier of science where she could do a new experiment. And so ultimately became interested in the notion of political terror and its and where it comes from, actually. And so we met with, oh my gosh, so many different scientists, from the Italian scientist who was studying mice and their reaction to sort of fearful signals, and to MRI kind of imaging scientists in England, and so on and so forth. And it was not working, and she was not really, it was not their vocabulary was not hers at all. And we ended up 3 months before the exhibition in Cambridge in Massachusetts, and met with Mazarin Banerjee, who's a also Indian, is a incredible woman and professor of neuroscience and psychology. And it led to
and it's something I describe in the book, this poetic, very intense dialogue between Mazarin, who is as a scientist, is very interested in the subconscious mind and how it influences us with regard to prejudice and other things. And Shilpa ultimately ended up creating a work which was several thousand microphones in a cloud kind of shape hanging from the ceiling. And as you walked into this space, these microphones, many of them were actually singing out at you. And it was Shilpa's voice. And actually, you know, it was sort of emotionally heart-wrenching because she was singing. And there was other sounds, and it kind of moved as a like a train around the cloud. And it was ultimately the, if you will, the subconscious mind of humanity, or the kind of the those without a voice, if you will, and what had happened here was that as she was doing this, right at the end there in November, there was a terrorist attacks in Mumbai, and so Shilpa was supposed to come to Paris, and she was holed up in her apartment, and these, you know, I don't know if you remember that, but these bombs were going on. It was an incredible moment, and so the work, which is now in the permanent collection of the Louisiana Museum, was for all of us who participated in the process just this stunning. You could hardly walk into the space and not be emotional, actually. And so I do, in describing this experiment, reflect on that process, hard to pin down even on a page, as the artistic process, which I emphasize in the book, is this sort of intuitive, image-driven, comfortable with uncertainty, thriving in ambiguity process, where truth is not the reproducibility, but the validity, in the sense that it's anchored in a comprehensible, identifiable human experience. And that was something that absolutely lived in Shilpa's project. And I do talk about the other project too. And I just then to take a step back and say that in a, you know, here I am in Paris right next to the Louvre and the Centre Pompidou and these major cultural institutions where art is easily defined in a very classical way. And yet, as you look at artistic creation today, it is very unclassifiable. And it is fascinating to look at this dichotomy between art as process and art as outcome, or science as process and science as outcome, and try and curate that part of the dichotomy, which is most universal and is most at stake when I say I'm an artist or I'm a scientist. And I don't know that we do that very well, but that's the goal.
And one of the things that also lets us in the little time that we have left get to is another very important part of the book and this project you're describing here that we haven't yet talked about, which is the these kind of vehicles for idea translation that have resulted in some actual like concrete products that are helping to fund and support and sustain these processes, right? And so one of the projects that you describe among many is this MuseTrek yes. project that actually explicitly engaged with Gupta's work.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so, well, did I interrupt you?
No, not at all. I'd love to, whatever you'd like to share about that, we'd love to hear.
Well, let me make the broad point first here that at the end of the day, sustainability is a major question for all of us, and certainly in a creative environment, having a sustainable model is key to the freest possible creative work and action. Sustainability at times has been related to kings giving money for in the patron sense, and to, you know, ministries of culture, and to maybe a Hollywood movie industry, basically. But
it is fascinating to, and key today, to figure out how to make sustainable creative work and not have it completely connected to, you know, I'll just be really explicit, either the industrial or the military industry or organizations, which has been much of the history of the last 50 years. If you look at how even what we talk about the artistic and scientific creativity here, the reality is if you look at resources spent on creative work over the last five decades, it has been far and away on scientific research and related to clear outcomes ultimately, even though early, fortunately, a lot of it upstream is much more open-ended. So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in a model where you can have a very open-ended kind of parallel research environment, parallel to the classical existing traditional scientific research process, where art is the driver and the vocabulary and cultural exhibition as opposed to peer-reviewed publication is the means of engagement and communication. And so the fact that things do come out and can be sold is important. And both it is encouraged investment in the early stage work in that there's some belief that something will come out, and it does also generate revenues. And so one of the projects that has come out here, as you mentioned, is called MuseTrack. And MuseTrack has not been a big commercial success, but it was a fascinating product and process wherein we, and notably the students who developed MuseTrack, were interested in coming back to this core issue of the process if being the focus. And yet, when you go into a museum, if you, and it's so fascinating to go into the Louvre and watch how 8 million people go through the Louvre every year, and it's just people are running through the Louvre, actually, with the maps and trying to get the few pieces of art. And so the thought was to try and create a platform whereby more and more people could actually enter into a cultural institution and have a drama in their minds like a curator of the Louvre has when he or she walks into the Louvre and immediately sees thousands of fascinating stories and is engaged in a way that we're not the first time we're in the Louvre. And so we thought about this MuseTrack and came up with this platform, basically a cell phone-based platform, whereby people could tell their own stories around works of art. And honestly, that project is very much in the air right now in terms of lots of other media that are going on in museums right now. I'm kind of, there are lots of barriers to that. And so it's almost a whole other conversation in itself. Maybe leave that aside for a second, just say that the projects that right now are driving revenue for the what we do are very related to culinary creativity. And I maybe will end here by saying that we have found over the last several years that the culinary art form is a fascinating one for many reasons, including the fact that the public enters very easily into the experimental process and is engaged in a way that they are not always when standing in front of an iPhone or in front of a picture on a wall. And it has led to just some really fun and now useful idea development around what we call aerosol cuisine and now edible bottles, which Wiki Cells are two platforms that have led to investment and frankly quite a
quite a an experience here over the last months is one of these products has come out and in a very mass market way. And so you've got the lab guy suddenly in the complete mass market environment, and it's just another great learning process. As these ideas move from one local classroom setting to an exhibition to a store to national television, they need tweaks, they need design changes, and all that are kind of adjusting to the audience. And it's fascinating and ultimately part of the sustainable model.
That's good. Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I teach a course on sensory forms of knowledge, and got to eat at El Bulli as part of this and teach about this sort of art science collaboration in the culinary world, and students really really relate to that topic. So I can't wait to assign this book as well.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much, David. I know I don't want to take up any more of your time, but if you don't mind, if we could just end our conversation or this interview by asking you, what's inspiring you, especially right now?
I am, well, there's some things I can't talk about, but I am very deeply involved in Wiki Cells, which are these edible bioforms where we are making yogurts and fruit and other things that where everything is edible and kind of based on the biological cell. So maybe that's, and I actually have a product coming out just in a few weeks with Philippe Stark called the Wah, W-A-H-H. Which is a little spray, we call these sprays quantum sensations, where we're looking to deliver sensations, whether they're incredible olfactive sensations or even kind of inebriated kind of sensations, but that have no duration. So they last just for a brief second and then they go away. And so it will be coming out on the 2nd of May. So that's actually quite a significant project.
Well, congratulations. And thank you so much for taking time. And for listeners, there's a ton of material and really just wonderful stories and discussions in this book that we haven't had a chance to talk about today. But I hope listeners will be inspired to pick it up and read it for themselves.
Thank you, Carla. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next time.